United States v. Thompson, Mr. Thies. We're never getting to the bottom of that.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Bill Thies, and I represent Christopher Thompson. The Court below in this case did something that no appellate court has ever condoned in the past, and really for good reason. The procedure that should have been followed here is set out in court rule. It is not a matter for the judge's discretion. The court rules make it reasonably clear what course of action is to be taken. The two principal rules are 32-1 and 43.
43 doesn't apply.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Rule 43 doesn't apply.
No, it's 32.1 and 43. If I said 42, I misspoke.
No, Rule 43 doesn't apply. That applies to sentencings only, which this was not. This is a supervised release revocation hearing. And the defendant had already been sentenced some years earlier.
It's true that the defendant had a sentencing for the original offense, but the way the rules are set up, when he comes back for a supervised release revocation, that too is a sentencing.
Actually, that's not right. Under either rule 32.1 or Section 3583, which covers revocation of supervised release. Supervised release is a component of the original sentence, right? Because at the time of original sentencing, the sentence is bifurcated. The offender gets a term of imprisonment followed by a term of supervised release. The term of supervised release is part of the original sentence. So the sentencing for Rule 43 purposes occurs at the time of the original adjudication of guilt and the original imposition of sentencing. This is a return of the defendant to prison following a supervised release violation and a revocation of supervised release. It's not a new sentencing.
It's certainly true that at the time of the original sentencing, the supervised release term is a part of the sentence.
Well, that doesn't cease to be true later on.
But we get the added component that at the revocation hearing, the judge says, I find you violated your supervised release, and this is what I'm going to do to punish you. The judge doesn't automatically give the defendant the entire term of supervised release. The judge makes an individualized assessment of what sort of punishment the defendant should have for that violation.
Right, but that's not a sentencing. It's a return to prison.
It is a return to prison, of course, but it is following a sentencing in the sense that a judge is saying to a defendant, I'm going to punish you.
But none of the rules, nor the statutes, nor the regulatory scheme refer to it as a sentencing. I mean, colloquially, that's what counsel and the court and the probation officer and so forth may refer to it as, but that's not really what it is under the rules and the statutes. I mean, the defendant is always under the custody and control of the Bureau of Prisons, right, pursuant to the original sentence. And that continues to be his status while he's on supervised release.
That's correct.
He's not being sentenced anew. He's being forced to give back supervised release time. That's the whole structure of a bifurcated sentence, right?
Right. But during that time that he's on supervised release, he certainly has the potential of doing fine and receiving...
It's conditional liberty.
No further punishment. In any realistic sense of the word, there's a big difference between going for a period of 2 years under the possibility of going back to prison and being told during that course of the 2 years, aha, you will now go back to prison.
No, I understand the stakes. I'm talking about what this is as a legal matter.
What
Let me focus on the other rule that is of critical importance here, Rule 43, because Rule 43...
Rule 43 only applies if this is a sentencing. That was my whole point.
But
if this
I
is not properly characterized as a sentencing, then Rule 43 is not in play.
We need to take a look at the second part of Rule 43, in which it sets out the situations in which the defendant's presence is not required. And it's very specific in talking about Rule 35 motions, motions for retroactive relief. And it says not one word about supervised release revocations. So
why,
when you've got a rule
that...
I believe it does. When you have a rule that sets up, here are the situations in which presence is required, and here are the situations in which it is not required, the most immediate question or the most immediate observation is that if we don't have something mentioned in the second part, it must be mentioned or included in the first part. And that ties in with the general structure of the rules, because the drafters made it very clear when they amended Rules 5 and 10 that they were concerned about video proceedings, and they were willing to allow them to occur, but only in those two limited situations of initial appearance and arraignment, and only if the defendant consented.
Right. So you think video teleconferencing would be authorized under 32.1 if the defendant consented to such a procedure?
Right now, the rule leaves that unclear, and Amicus, I don't know if the court had a chance to see it, submitted a 28J letter yesterday in which one of the proposals is to allow video conferencing under 32.1, but only if the defendant consents. Now, I realize that the court is not bound by what the Rules Committee is thinking about doing, but it certainly should indicate to the court what is the common understanding in these matters. And in fact, the 28J letter that the amicus submitted yesterday, we believe, is very helpful to our position because it makes clear what the structure is that the Rules Committee has envisioned.
Do you know when Judge Reinhart was scheduled to return from Florida? I mean, what was the rush to conduct this revocation proceeding?
There was nothing in the record, Your Honor. As a matter of fact, a week previously, when Mr. Thompson was originally before the court, Judge Reinhart said, in connection with another sentencing, and that's in the appendix, that he was going to be back next week for the date that he set Mr. Thompson's proceeding. The parties come back to the courthouse on that appointed date when Judge Reinhart said he was going to be available, and as it turned out, he was not in the courthouse. He was down in Key West. There was no explanation as to why he was still there, contrary to his original prediction. There was certainly...
Is he on vacation?
Yes.
Your Honor, I think at that time he was a senior judge, so I might guess that, you know, Florida was a nicer place at that time of the year, but that really would be guessing on my part.
Nobody moved for an adjournment? Apparently?
There was, Judge Reinhart acknowledged an objection to proceeding that way. No one said, Your Honor, I move for an adjournment. But I would take an objection to be the same as moving for an adjournment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Thies. Ms. Sahoyo?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to begin just with the point that you raised, Your Honor.
Speak a little louder. I'm
of course. None of the cases cited by defendant that hold that a judge and a defendant must be in the same room, physically present in the same room, govern this case, because those cases all addressed Rule 43 sentencing. This case, in contrast, is controlled by Rule 32.1 because it was a supervised release revocation hearing. But none of the authorities cited by the defendant answers the question presented in this case, which is whether a judge may participate in such a hearing by video conference. So this court is writing on a relatively...
So does the judge have to be present electronically? Or in any way?
Well, we think that the defendant needs to have an opportunity to appear under Rule 32.1, and the defendant in this case did have that. Well, yes, the defendant in this case did appear.
Appear where?
He appeared in the courthouse in Illinois.
In the courthouse where nobody else, where there's no judge.
The judge participated in the hearing by conference.
Does the judge have to participate?
Yes, Your Honor.
You can't say, I'll read the transcript?
No, Your Honor.
So, in other words, if the defendant simply sent a letter to the court in place of allocuting in person, you wouldn't agree to that?
We would not agree to that.
Could all parties participate by video teleconferencing in different places?
I'm not sure. We think that in this, well, of course, the court doesn't have to reach that question to decide this case.
I know, but it's a slippery slope here.
We think that with all parties participating by a video conference, it's a flexible inquiry. At some point, it might get too far afloat from the purposes of the rule, which is to ensure the defendant has a full.
Well, you say an opportunity to appear. Well, of course, the word appear is often used without any reference to a personal appearance.
That's right.
So why don't you just say he has an opportunity to present, present evidence. He can, write a letter and send an email.
Well, we think even if you read the language of the rule narrowly, appear is covered by video conferencing at least, because video conferencing...
Well, doesn't that depend on the adequacy of video conferencing as a substitute for face-to-face?
Yes, Your Honor. And we just point out that in this case, the defendant...
So where is the discussion of the adequacy of video conferencing?
Well, the judge in this case noted that he could
see... Look, a lot of people are not comfortable in a video conference setting.
In this case, the judge stated on the record that he could see and hear everything
in
the courtroom.
Has this defendant ever been in a video conference before?
That's not reflected in the record.
Well, I don't know if you have any experience with this kind of stuff. People who are experienced in dealing with video conference, they can sit in front of a camera. They've not seen anybody. They sit in front of a camera, and they can respond as they would in person. But for people who have no experience with video conferencing, it's very awkward. They don't feel the same as when there's a human being in the same room.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the judge...
I don't see in this case, because I don't see any evidence that the judge knows anything about this person and whether he is equipped by experience to participate in a video conference rather than actually seeing the judge.
There was no objection made on that ground. There's no indication that the defendant had a difficult time speaking up or representing his position. The defendant was addressed by the court and he spoke to the court. The defendant was asked twice by the judge actually to speak on his
behalf. Well, would you consider this an appropriate procedure for sentencing?
Well, not for ordinary criminal sentencing under Rule 43.
Well, forget Rule 43. If we were writing on a clean slate, would you think it should be in the discretion of the judge whether in sentencing the defendant should be physically present? Not the defendant, the judge should be physically present.
Your Honor, I'm not sure it's possible to get away from Rule 43.
Of course it is possible to get away from Rule 43. I'm asking a hypothetical question. Suppose there were no Rule 43. Would you consider it appropriate for a judge to say, I prefer Key West to Chicago, so I do all my court business online. I will sentence you on my computer, and you'll be in the courtroom, and I'll see you make your allocution, and then I'll sentence you. Would that be okay?
No, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because of the due process clause and the heightened...
What does the due process clause have to do with anything?
Well, in the absence of
the due process clause doesn't say anything about television or allocution or being in person or anything like that. Why do you retreat to the due process clause? You just tell me as a matter of of sensible penological practice. Is there anything wrong with video sentencing?
Well, in the ordinary criminal context, the defendant has a heightened interest in being present and being able to address the court.
Why?
Because that
is just as good to be talking to a TV as talking to a person. Why? What's the difference?
The difference.
I mean, now you're arguing something different. You say this is trivial. It's just revocation. But it seems to me not so trivial for someone who's sent to prison.
Not that, Your Honor, that we're saying that it's a trivial context.
Is it just as good as in person?
It's good enough.
Is it as good as in person?
In this context,
is
yes.
Is it as good?
Yes, in this context.
Look, suppose this person is being sentenced where the maximum punishment is 2 years in prison. And compare that with a case where his revocation, if his supervised release is revoked, he'll go back to prison for 2 years. So you have symmetrical length of imprisonment. So is it your view that in that setting, if you're sent back for 2 years in a revocation proceeding, that's good enough?
Yes.
Then why isn't it good enough if you're sentenced to 2 years? Rather than revoked for 2 years?
Because a defendant has an absolute interest in liberty that's much greater in the original criminal context.
I don't understand you. 2 years is 2 years. Why is the liberty interest any greater? Because it's original sentence rather than a revocation.
Because that's what the Supreme Court has held.
Well, that's not an answer. You tell me why, as a matter of common sense, it makes sense to distinguish between 2 years in a sentence and 2 years in a revocation.
The defendant, when he's under a revocation proceeding, has already had his liberty been restricted by an original criminal sentence. It's been
but he hasn't been sent to two prison. I mean, suppose he's been revoked. The revocation is on the basis of a claim that he denies that he committed some criminal act. So it's exactly like an original criminal charge, and it's going to have the same consequences in terms of imprisonment. But the important point is, you say it's a bigger interest if it's an original sentence. That must mean that there really is some difference between the judges being there in person and being on a TV screen. Because if there's no difference, if they're absolutely identical in the electronic age, then there's no reason to make any distinction between sentencing and revocation.
Yes, we agree that there is a difference.
What is the difference? Now explain that to me.
Nothing in the record that
establishes. What is the difference? You said there's a difference. Now tell me what the difference is.
The difference would be the lack of the judge's ability to directly look the defendant eye to eye. I mean, just the difference in not being physically able to speak to somebody face-to-face. The difference is just the actual difference.
Well, how about the defendant's difficulty in talking to a screen rather than a person?
It's a symmetrical question. The judge's distance from the defendant is identical to the defendant's distance from the judge.
I know, but you see, the judge is not going to jail.
I'm sorry?
The judge is not going to be sent to jail.
Oh, no.
And let me just tell you what my real problem is. It is so much more difficult to pick up on nuances, on expressive behavior. A lot of things that really do influence a sitting judge. For all we know, there are technical difficulties. Just a lot of differences.
It is true that you know, as technology moves on, these differences, are there. These alternatives may not be the same thing as physically being there, but that doesn't mean that courts should be prohibited from using these technologies, especially when the Supreme Court has been so explicit in endorsing procedural flexibility in the context of 32.1 hearings.
Well, that's relevant to the due process claim here, not so much to the statutory claim. The statute mandates an appearance, and the question is whether video conferencing constitutes a valid appearance under the statute, and that requires some active interpretation, it seems to me. What is meant by the word opportunity to appear?
But the language
is that a personal opportunity to appear before the judge live and in person?
We don't think so. I mean, that the language of the rule 32.1 is expressly drawn from Morrissey and from Gagnon, and it's meant to incorporate just the due process minimums, just the rudiments of due process for hearings like this.
Is it clear from the record that everybody was able to see each other?
Yes, we think so. I mean, the judge spoke to each person, to the
defendant. Well, we know the judge could see everybody because he said he could, but do we know that the defendant and counsel could see the judge? Was it two-way interactive or one-way interactive?
It was two-way interactive. They each spoke to each other, and there's no indication that the defendant couldn't see the judge or was restricted in any way from addressing the judge.
And we do know that, I understand you just said that there's no indication that he couldn't, but is there an affirmative indication that he could, that this was two-way interactive video?
The indication is just that the defendant spoke to the judge.
Well, did he speak to a camera, or did he have a picture of the judge in the courtroom that he was looking at? Is it like, you know, on Skype?
I'm not familiar with Skype, Your Honor, but I'm not sure.
Where was he? Where was the judge?
The judge was in Key West, Florida.
No. Where was he? Was he at home?
I think it says that he was in a courthouse in Key West, but I'm not sure.
Was he in a court? I mean, Judge Sykes' question, very germane. Was he in a courthouse that had video conferencing equipment so that he was visible to the defendant?
I'm afraid that the record doesn't explain what equipment was available to him.
But you wouldn't make any distinction. He could be on a telephone for all you care, right?
No, Your Honor. We wouldn't.
Why not?
Because to appear, you know, implies to be visible.
Well, don't you have a hole in the case then if we don't know whether the judge was visible?
The record doesn't establish that the judge was visible, except that it uses the term video conference, which implies visibility, rather than teleconference, which implies just being audible.
Well, here's what's strange about your argument. So you agree, under pressure, that there is a difference. Maybe it's a small difference between the judges being there in person and the judges being somewhere else. But here's what's strange about this. There's nothing on the other side. I mean, usually when we talk about relaxing procedural protections, we have a reason. We have some value on the other side, law enforcement or what have you, which is fine. There's nothing on the other side.
Well,
judges can be in courtrooms when they revoke people's probation, right?
That is true.
The judge isn't arguing, look, I don't want to be in Chicago, a lousy winter. I want to do my judicial business from Key West. And we don't recognize this as the kind of claim which might offset some procedural right.
It's
a peculiarly one-sided case. There's nothing on the other side.
Well,
There's no social benefit for having judges do their revocations by video conferences.
The presence or absence of a social benefit cannot change what the rules permit.
That's ridiculous. That's an absurd. We're interpreting the word appear. It's not self-defining. And the interpretation is going to be shaped by the values that are served by one interpretation versus another. Your interpretation has absolutely nothing to recommend it. There is no benefit.
Well, Your Honor, we think that it actually does. I mean, having the ability to conduct this is a valuable, conducts hearings like this by video conference can promote efficiency and economy.
No, it can't. Look, for the courts of appeals, The judges have their offices, you know, across the circuit. So there are real economies from allowing video conferencing. Similarly, when they have lawyers who are remote, you know, Second Circuit does a lot of video conferencing. That's fine. That's a convenience thing. But district judges are in the city where their courtroom is, and they come into court. They do their traditional business in the courtroom. They're not supposed to be living. What? I mean, if Judge Reinhardt, suppose he wants to spend next year living at the Four Seasons in Bora Bora. And you say, I'll be set, I'll have the best equipment, I can do everything. I'll sentence people, I'll conduct jury trials, I'll do everything. And would we say, well, you know, maybe there's something that violates a rule about sentencing or something. But nevertheless, we recognize it would be very nice if we could let Judge Reinhardt spend the year in Bora Bora. Right? Wouldn't that be rather ludicrous?
But I agree that it would be, and it would be impossible for him to conduct most of his duties by video conference. For instance,
I can Skype with my son in London. It's just like he's in the next room.
I mean, he would
technologically possible.
It is, but it's only authorized in this instance. I mean, it's only authorized for supervised release revocation hearings. It's not authorized for trials.
But there isn't any systemic justification for this. That's the point that's being made. Your client had been revoked on another charge and was in prison, and we wanted to save some money by not bringing him to the courthouse and set up a video system for that sort of a thing, maybe you could argue there were systemic justification.
In all seriousness, the trend has been to add video conferencing to various rules over time. We think that trend is only increasing. In the 28J letter we submitted, you'll see that there's several separate rules in which video conferencing is now mentioned as an alternative.
Of course, and you can think of good reasons for it. Witnesses in the wrong place and so on. It's just here there's no reason for it.
The language of the rule authorizes it.
No, it doesn't. That depends on what appear means. Right?
Appear, we believe, is satisfied by appearance via video conference. To instruct judges to not do it, I mean, it could be a question of judicial management. This court obviously has supervisory authority over the district courts to instruct them not to use the procedure, but the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure apply to all courts, and it would be inappropriate to read into the rule a prohibition on judicial video conferencing.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Ms. Solony. So, do you have anything further, Mr. Tice?
Just a couple things. There was a question about whether the record reflected whether the people in Rockford could see Judge Reinhardt, and the record on that is really silent on. Appendix page 19 of our brief, the judge states that he's in the courthouse in Key West, Florida. We're doing this by video conferencing. I can both see and hear everybody in the courthouse in Rockford and can comprehend everything that has transpired, but there's no statement going in the other direction. One final thing, and this is in our brief, the Sixth Circuit opinion in Terrell, which is a parole revocation case, sets out a very good analysis of the word appear and how that should factor into a court's construction of the statute. And I realize there are other considerations, and the court, I think, is well advised when it points out that we do have to balance things on both sides, and there doesn't seem to be anything on the other side. But if we want to look at just the use of the language of appear, Terrell is a very good roadmap. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And you were appointed, Mr. Tice. Yeah, well, we thank you, and we certainly thank Ms. Sahoney and her firm for accepting the thankless assignment on the other side and doing such a good job.